Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming today. On behalf of the Thoreau Society, I'm Ed Cottrell. We also want to thank the American Constitution Society for co-sponsoring this event. We have two very distinguished guests today. Judge Richard Posner is on the Seventh Circuit, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Has been there for 25 years, including a seven-year term as the chief judge of that circuit. He has also been a professor here at the law school, where he's currently a senior lecturer. Brian Leiter is a professor at the University of Texas with joint appointments in law and philosophy. He is an expert on Nietzsche. He is also the founder of the law and philosophy program there and has been voted professor of the year by his students. We're very blessed to have both these speakers today. If you'll give them a big round of applause, Professor Leiter is going to start us off.
Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk with Judge Posner about his provocative and always refreshingly candid views about law and about adjudication. There is a handout that is circulating around. Do people in the back have it? It's a couple of pages from Judge Posner's 1999 book, The Problematics of Moral and Legal Theory. And what I was going to propose to do was start by reading some of this where Judge Posner sets out his view of what he calls pragmatic adjudication. And then I want to pose a series of questions about it. This has been framed as a debate, but I think it's actually, I hope, going to be more of a discussion and an opportunity to clarify some of the contours of what he calls pragmatic adjudication. So if you've got the handout or if your neighbor has the handout, take a look at page 241, not the first full paragraph, but the second full paragraph. I'm not going to read all of this, but I'm going to read a good chunk of it in order to frame our discussion. So Judge Posner writes, "What then is pragmatic adjudication? I do not accept Ronald Dworkin's definition." And now he quotes from Dworkin's 1986 book, Law's Empire, where Dworkin characterizes a view he calls pragmatism, though as often happens when Dworkin characterizes a view, he doesn't actually identify anybody who's supposed to be holding it. He says, the pragmatist thinks judges should always do the best they can for the future in the circumstances, unchecked by any need to respect or secure consistency in principle with what other officials have done or will do. That's Dworkin's characterization. Judge Posner says, that is Dworkin the polemicist speaking, indeed. But if his definition is rewritten as follows, pragmatist judges always try to do the best they can do for the present and the future, unchecked by any felt duty to secure consistency in principle with what other officials have done in the past, then it will do as a working definition of pragmatic adjudication. On this construal, the difference between a pragmatic judge and a judge who is a legal positivist. Now, I must put my jurisprudential hat on and say that no legal positivist holds the view that's about to be described, but this isn't just a terminological quibble, which is I would prefer to call this view formalism, and I do indeed think that there are people who are advocates of this particular view. So I'm just going to substitute formalist in this context. The legal formalist, in the strong sense of believing that the law is a system of rules laid down by legislatures and merely applied by judges, is that while the latter type of judge, that is this formalist, is centrally concerned with securing consistency with past enactments, the former, that's the pragmatist, is concerned with securing consistency with the past only to the extent that deciding in accordance with precedent may be the best method for producing the best results for the future. And now if you'd skip over to 242, the paragraph beginning, the judicial pragmatist has different priorities. He wants to come up with the decision that will be best with regard to present and future needs. He is not uninterested in past decisions, in statutes, and so forth. Far from it. For one thing, these are repositories of knowledge, even sometimes of wisdom. So it would be folly to ignore them, even if they had no authoritative significance. For another, a decision that destabilized the law by departing too abruptly from precedent might, on balance, have bad consequences. Judges often must choose between rendering substantive justice in the case at hand and maintaining the law's certainty and predictability. The trade-off, posed most starkly in cases in which the statute of limitations is asserted as a defense, will sometimes point to sacrificing substantive justice in the individual case to consistency with previous cases or with statutes, or in short, with well-founded expectations necessary to the orderly management of society's business. Another reason not to ignore the past is that often it is difficult to determine the purpose and scope of a rule without tracing the rule to its origins. So the pragmatist judge regards precedent, statutes, and constitutional text both as sources of potentially valuable information about the likely best result in the present case and as signposts that he must be careful not to obliterate or obscure gratuitously because people may be relying upon them. But because he sees these, quote, authorities merely as sources of information and as limited constraints on his freedom of decision, he does not depend on them to supply the rule of decision for the truly novel case. He looks to sources that bear directly on the wisdom of the rule that he is being asked to adopt or to modify. So that is our statement, and I think representative statement of Judge Posner's conception of pragmatic adjudication. And I want to raise four general questions about it. First question is this. On Judge Posner's view, do judges in fact have any obligation or duty to abide by precedents or statutes or constitutions? And I want to repeat that because it may seem a surprising question. Is it the case on the pragmatic view of adjudication that judges in fact have an obligation, right, to abide by precedents and statutes and constitutions, or do they merely have instrumental reasons to sometimes want to take them seriously? Right? I'll explain what I think is the contrast between those two. Let me just remind you now of a few things that Judge Posner has said here. He says, the pragmatist judge is unchecked by any felt duty, and that's Judge Posner's emphasis, to secure consistency in principle with past official actions, that is, court decisions and legislative enactments. Judges are unchecked by any felt sense of duty or obligation, right, to be consistent with past official actions, court decisions, legislative enactments, and so on. He says the pragmatist judge only decides in accordance with precedent when that is the best method for producing the best results for the future. So if there is a reason to take precedent seriously, to accord it weight in decision making, it's because instrumentally it's an effective means for securing the best result in that particular context. He says the pragmatist judge is not uninterested in statutes and precedents. Now, of course, to say the judge is not uninterested in statutes and precedents isn't the same as saying the judge necessarily has an obligation to apply them. The judge is not uninterested in them, but why isn't the pragmatist judge uninterested in statutes and precedents? And here I quote again, because he regards precedents, statutes, and constitutional text both as sources of potentially valuable information about the likely best result in the present case and as signposts that he must be careful not to obliterate or obscure gratuitously because people may be relying upon them. In other words, what it sounds like to me is that the actual obligation of the pragmatic judge is to reach the best outcome, and falling out of that obligation may sometimes be a reason to accord consideration to past official acts, either because they are repositories of insight into what the best outcome might be, or because they have formed the basis of settled expectations, which if those expectations and plans were unsettled, would itself undermine achieving the best outcome for the present and for the future. So that's my first general question here. Is there an obligation, or is it merely hostage to, right, the instrumental value of considering legislative enactments, precedents, constitutional texts, and so on? Okay. Second general question. what happens when judges disagree about what the best outcome is? And there are two kinds of possible disagreement we might imagine here in a legal system in which all judges read these pages from the book and took them to heart and saw their obligation as one of producing the best outcome. First off, they might disagree about what the criteria for best outcomes are. Some judges might think the best outcomes are the ones that maximize the satisfaction of revealed preferences as revealed in the marketplace. Some judges might think that the best outcome is actually the one that maximizes the satisfaction of ideal preferences, that is, the preferences people would have under conditions of full information and rationality. Some judges might think that the best outcome is actually the one that maximizes well-being, where well-being or utility is not understood in a way that has anything to do with preference satisfaction, but in terms of various kinds of objective criteria. So Martha Nussbaum's capabilities approach would be an example. We want to maximize the distribution and availability of those capabilities in the population at large. And of course, then, some judges might not think the best outcome has anything to do with maximizing at all. Some judges might think the best outcome has to do with protecting and enforcing people's rights, with doing justice, where justice is to be understood in non-utilitarian terms, and so on. All right? So judges might disagree about what the criteria of best are, but even if judges agree about what the criteria for the best outcome is, they may disagree about the application of those criteria in any particular case. Now, the second kind of disagreement is presumably going to be less serious because judges often agree on criteria that bear on a decision, but may disagree about questions of application, and that does not seem to undermine the functioning of the legal system. More worrisome, I think, is the first kind of disagreement. And I think disagreement about what the best outcome, what the criteria for the best outcome is supposed to be, would be almost inevitable. That there would be quite significant disagreement, just as there is quite significant disagreement in society at large about moral and political questions, right, that engage the public. If there is such disagreement about the best outcome, and if the obligations of judges on the pragmatic view are to reach the best outcomes, the worry now becomes, how are people to plan their affairs and predict what the legal consequences of their actions will be? Because after all, it may now seem that what the legal ramifications of your actions are will be hostage to what judge ends up here in your case and what that judge's view is about the criteria of a best outcome. That's my second general question. Third and fourth will be briefer. The third one, and this is one we've discussed before and that Judge Posner addresses in his book on law, pragmatism, and democracy. You might think, look, in a democracy, right, appointed judges, unelected judges, do have a significant obligation to legislation in particular, right, to the will of the people as expressed through the legislative process and legislation that is passed by democratically elected legislators. How is this conception of pragmatic adjudication compatible with this simple thought, right? This simple thought that the legitimacy and propriety of what judges are doing, right, requires them to be bound and constrained by democratically enacted legislation. And the fourth question is, if we had a universe, not a universe, but at least a legal system here, in which pragmatic adjudication were the norm, it seems to me that the confirmation process for judges would have to be considerably different than the one we actually have. That is, if the fundamental obligation of judges were to produce the best outcomes, right, with regard for precedent and statutes and constitutions only insofar as they were instrumentally useful to bringing about best outcomes, then our confirmation process ought to be, it seems, primarily about how judges conceive what is best, that is, what their criteria for the best outcomes are supposed to be. And then the confirmation of judges would look much more like what at present it always tries to avoid being, a discussion of the substantive moral and political principles that the judges subscribe to. So, those are my four questions for Judge Posner. And I may reply to some of his remarks, or I may not, and we may just open it up for discussion at that point.
Okay, well, the first question is about what obligations the judge has to the past. And I did say in the pages that Professor Leiter referred to that I recognize the judges have there are constraints on their conduct, but limited. And the way I like to put it is that there are certain rules of the judicial game, you know, like the rules of chess. And if you don't abide by the rules, you're not playing the game. So, for example, if you have a statute which is clear not only in terms of what it says, but in context and so on, and it produces a result that is, you know, not preposterous, then I think a judge would feel that he had to, and it was constitutional and so on, then I think a judge would feel that he had to comply with it. And similarly, if the precedent is a decision by a superior court that's absolutely clear and obviously applicable to the present case, then I think the judge feels obliged. I had a case some years ago. The Supreme Court had held many years ago a case called Albrecht that it was illegal per se for a manufacturer, say, to tell a distributor that you can't charge more than a specified price to your customers, can't have maximum price fixing. And this issue arose in a case I had, the Kahn case, and I said this was a ridiculous rule, and it was inconsistent with the later trend of Supreme Court decisions, but it was the rule, and the Supreme Court had told us we're not supposed to anticipate the overruling of their decisions. So I said we'd apply Albrecht and hope the Supreme Court would grant cert in reverse, which indeed it did. So that was an example of a constraint decision. But what's interesting to me is that even at my level, and certainly at the Supreme Court level, these constraints are at the Supreme Court almost never in play. But at my level, very often not in play, especially in civil cases. You know, in criminal cases, most criminal defendants are indigent, so they have their lawyer paid for, so they have no real disincentive to appeal most of the time. Not always, sometimes they get in trouble appealing. But civil litigants generally do not appeal unless they have an arguable case, maybe a weak case, but at least arguable. So a significant fraction of our cases are outside these, you know, the rules. They're not constrained by precedent or by statutory language or anything of that sort. And that kind of open area is very interesting. And it seems to me in that area, there aren't any techniques by which rigorously, demonstrably correct outcomes can be derived, whether it's reasoning by analogy or canons of statutory construction or what have you. They're quite arbitrary. So all the judge is left with is a sense of, you know, what is a sensible outcome, and the reasoning process, I think, is the same that non-lawyers would apply ordinary questions about what to do. And the lawyers, the judges have a special vocabulary and so on. But I don't think there's anything special. I don't think there's anything to the canons of construction or reasoning by analogy and so on. So it becomes a policy judgment and strongly influenced by the facts. I do think it's very important, and it came out in the passage that Professor Leiter read, that the judge not be influenced solely by the adjudicative facts, the facts bearing on the particular case. Professor Leiter, who's a great expert on legal realism, quoted one of the realists, I think it was Llewellyn, was it, as saying that, you know, your case is won or lost in an appeal by your statement of facts. And I don't think that's accurate. They're very important, but the facts that don't go in the statement of facts are also very important. And they're facts like the importance of making written contracts, a reliable way of specifying a transaction by paying attention to what the contract says, not just immediately flying to some sense of what it should have said. And so with statutes, want to enable Congress to legislate, you have to pay considerable attention to what they say. So that those kind of facts, importance of maintaining communication, so on, and protecting people's reliance on what they thought was their contract or statute. Those are important considerations. So it all seems to me come down to facts. Now, often these facts can't really be determined with any accuracy, and then people evaluate them on the basis of their life experiences, their temperament, their ideology, and so on. So that's just, it seems to me, the way things are. So that then brings up these additional questions, Professor Leiter raises. So, what happens when judges disagree about what is the best result, the correct result, and so on? Well, they disagree. Now, sometimes the disagreement can be resolved because one judge knows something that the others don't and can persuade them. But often there's no way to resolve the disagreement, so it comes down to voting, right? So, if you look at split decisions in our court or in the Supreme Court, very often all you can say about them is that a majority thought one way, and they've trotted out a lot of arguments, but the other side has just as good arguments. So that I think is just that's just the way it is. So does this raise a problem of democracy? I don't think it really raises a problem. It if you're going to have a judiciary, you're going to have a large amount of judicial discretion. Now that's not true in all systems. If we had a very disciplined legislature, we would have much clearer statutes. If we didn't have a constitution, we would have much curtailed judicial discretion. If we had a career judiciary, the way the European countries do, where you start off as a traffic court judge or something, work your way up, so that you have to please your superiors, then you will tend to have a very docile, uncreative judiciary, typical kind of bureaucratic judiciary, and then you'll have more, less judicial discretion. But in our system, going to be a very complicated law because of federal and state law interactions with the Constitution, which is so old. Because we have a lateral entry judiciary, we don't have really professional judges. So for these and other reasons, we have a very unclear laws, and that creates enormous judicial discretion. That's just the way it is. There isn't any way around it. It's maybe it's undemocratic, but that's the way it is. But finally, with regard to confirmation, I don't think recognizing what I regard simply as obvious facts about our system, I don't think that would affect confirmation because the Senate knows all about this. They know that. Their confirmation hearings are designed to unmask the ideology of the nominee. I mean, it reaches ludicrous extremes with the Supreme Court nominations with the televised law. But even with the Court of Appeals judges, there is considerable recognition that these judges are going to exercise a lot of discretion, and the discretion can be guided by ideology and temperament and so on. With regard to the district judges, trial judges, much less concerned because they have a lot of discretion when it comes to determining the facts, but not much when it comes to legal rules. What actually keeps the system going, keeps it coherent, and actually is improved in this respect, is that this is a point that has been made about the common law in England, and people wondered why was the English common law, and it was created by the judges. Why was it really pretty predictable? So Max Weber, you know, great German sociologist, was surprised but convinced that the English common law actually provided a better framework for economic development than the code systems of the continental judiciaries. And it was puzzling because you think if legislature sat down and drafted a code, it would be very clear, whereas the judges just deciding case by case and someone trying to figure out how it all goes together, sort of thing, studying first year courses, how could that be coherent? Well, the answer seems to be that the English judges were pretty much peas in a pod, in the same social background, same experience as barristers, so they thought alike. Since they thought alike, they agreed. So it wasn't that they were somehow coerced by some methodology they had that would lead different types of people to the same result, which you see in science and so on. It's that they were similar people. But we have that in the federal judiciary to a considerable extent because there's an elaborate screening process by the FBI and the White House and the Senate Judiciary Committee, which tends to eliminate the extremes. And then there's the confirmation process where the senators are looking for and trying to prevent getting through the sieve, the oddballs, the extremists. So when I came through, when I was confirmed in 1981, very little attention was paid to Court of Appeals judges. My confirmation hearing lasted 5 minutes, literally. The big question that was asked me by Senator Thurmond, he was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1981. He was the only senator at my hearing, but there were several other judges and who were questioned before me. And the first question Thurmond asked each of them was, are there any members of your family present whom you would like to introduce to the committee? And everybody else had a wife or children or something to introduce the commitment. It came to me, asked me that question. I said no, because I hadn't been advised that it was customary to bring your family. So he looked at me, his brows constricted me. He said, "You do have a family." I was able to reassure him. The Reagan administration had, in fact, decided that it wanted to alter the ideological profile of the federal courts of appeals, wanted to make them more conservative. And this was not perceived in the fall of 1981, but it was soon. And as soon as we realized that there were ideological stakes regarding Court of Appeals nominees, the scrutiny given by the confirmation process became much more searching. And as a result, the Federal Court of Appeals judges have become more uniform. I mean, there are differences between the Democratic judges and Republican judges, but they have actually diminished. And so on my court and on most of the courts of appeals, unless the judges start scrapping with each other, usually for reasons that are not actually related to the law, we get along very well, very high rate of agreement. But as I say, it's because we are similar people, not because we have a methodology that enables us to compel people of different ideology, temperament, and so on to agree. So you look at scientists, physicists and chemists and biologists the world over, they may differ on every dimension from each other, politically and so on, temperament and so forth. But they generally agree on scientific matters because they have a methodology which persuades them, which overrides their personal preferences. But we don't have that in the law. And so if you want to have uniformity, you really have to have rather similar people. So those are my answers to your questions.
Good. Let me make two brief comments and then open it up for discussion. I forewarned the Federalist Society folks when they arranged this that I usually actually end up mostly agreeing with Judge Posner, so it wasn't necessarily going to be a debate. And now the way you have explained your view, almost everything you've said I agree with completely. I do think, though, you've added a certain clarification. The crucial answer was to the very first question. And the view you've now described is actually very, very close to H.L.A. Hart's view in The Concept of Law in that one chapter where he talks about adjudication, which is you say, look, there's a range of cases where the authoritative sources, the statutes, the precedents, it's clear what they require, right? And so the court's obligation is, in fact, to adhere to them. Now, maybe you think the reason they have to adhere to them is because of these additional considerations about settled expectations and so on and not unsettling things. But in those easy cases, the judge's obligation is the pretty straightforward obligation. And the real point, and this is Hart makes this point as well, is that there's a range of cases, especially at the appellate level, in which, in fact, the rules aren't clear and discretion must be exercised. At which point, then, pragmatic adjudication kicks in there where something has to kick in because there simply aren't authoritative materials that are going to dictate what the decision is supposed to be. And that strikes me as quite plausible. The one thing you said that I do disagree with slightly is about the confirmation process. You said quite plausibly it's obvious to everyone in the Senate that ideology and the political and moral beliefs of the nominees matter, right? And we know that that's obvious to them, just as it's obvious to the president when the president nominates these judges. But the official public, right, rhetoric of the process seems to me devoted to denying this. right? So that the nominees will frequently resist answering these questions. We will get the questions that, as I remember, you told me Senator Thurman asked you ages ago. If you're confirmed, you'll view it as your duty to make the law, and your duty to apply the law and not to make the law, and so on. And you'll never get a question in the following form that reflects the obviousness you're talking about. Maybe someone will correct me, but I've never heard the following question. So Mr. Smith, right, as an appellate judge, as we know from reading Judge Posner's writings, you're going to have to exercise discretion. You're going to get a lot of cases where the rules just aren't clear, right? What kind of moral and political considerations will you bring to bear in resolving those cases where the rules aren't clear? But that's presumably what the confirmation process ought to look like, given, as you say, that it's obvious that this is just an unavoidable aspect of the decision making that the judges have to make, especially at the appellate level.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. Yes, that was another funny aspect. So Senator, after we got over the family business, he asked me whether I agreed that it was the duty of judges to apply the law but not to make the law. And I said that was generally true, but of course there were, these ambiguous, difficult cases where the judge might have to fill a gap in the law. So he didn't react to that. But a few weeks later, I was sent the printed report of my test, the committee report with the testimony of the judges and so on. And presumably a staff person had changed my answer to yes. Be cynical about the confirmation process. but I think that would be a good question to ask a judge. Yeah, given that there's this large open area, what is going to guide you? So they'd ask me, ask someone like me, you write all about this economic analysis of law, so does that mean, economics is what will help you fill these gaps or what? No, I think that would be perfectly appropriate. It was ridiculous when Chief Justice Roberts to be, his confirmation hearing, compared a Supreme Court justice to a baseball umpire. Very ridiculous. Umpire has discretion about, calling a ball if it's not obvious, obviously over the center of the plate, obviously wide or high or low, he can call it a ball or a strike. There is a kind of factual uncertainty, but he can't change the rules. And of course, the Supreme Court is constantly changing rules. So that was sort of an embarrassment. But the problem is that there's a deep public I don't know quite how to describe it. It's actually just some strange irrationality, because on the one hand, people believe that the law is something that you find in a book, and judges are people who are skilled, at finding the right page in a book, and they really just apply law. They don't make law. So that's what people believe. On the other hand, people are extremely protective of the rights that they value, whatever the process that generated them. So the same person will say it would be outrageous to appoint a judge who would question Roe versus Wade, but the same person would think that the only proper function of a judge is to apply the law. And obviously Roe versus Wade was a creative judicial act. So when I say people seem to believe both of these things, which makes it very awkward for the confirmation process. And of course, judges are engaged in a conspiracy, really, to deceive people about the nature of the judicial function, because they want to be thought harmless, right? If people don't like their decisions, they want to say, don't blame me, I'm just applying the law. So this way, you know, they want to conceal their political power. And they're good at that. So they've convinced a lot of people. Let's say this is an uneasy juxtaposition between the, you know, Professor Leiter's kind of the orthodox belief the judges just apply the law, and the strong attachment people have to the rights that they value, regardless of the sort of pedigree of those rights. But I don't know why. Suppose someone like Roberts had said, well, you know, most of the time what judges do is apply the law, but especially at the Supreme Court level, a great deal of uncertainty in the law, so of course the judges are going to play a creative role. If they didn't, then you wouldn't have to have confirmation hearings at all, right? You just look at the judge's curriculum vitae and see whether he had the qualifications to be a good judge. I think a person could say that, and I don't think the sealing of the Senate Judiciary Committee's chamber would collapse. But that candor is not. Actually, one of the things that worries me is I think there are actually a lot of judges who believe that they're just applying the law. That's a very dangerous belief. It makes you quite irresponsible. Because if you're just applying the law, however nutty the result, well, then you don't take responsibility for it. You know, you say, I'm just a transmitter. Go argue with, you know, those people in 1787. So I think the judges who recognize they're exercising discretion are a lot likely to be more restrained and less confident because they realize that they can't prove that what they're doing is the answer they've come up with is correct. With regard to H.L.A. Hart, the concept of law, I don't know how many of you have read it, and this would be heresy to Professor Leiter. But what I don't like about the book is it's too English. So people write about jurisprudence, whether it's Hart or Dworkin or Habermas, you know, German philosopher wrote an interesting book, I mean, Facts and Values about Law. They purport to be speaking about a universal phenomenon, but actually, I think they end up just talking about their own legal system. And the English legal system, until recently, England subscribed to the European Convention on Human Rights, is pretty cut and dried. Because, you know, England has long had essentially a single unicameral legislature, the House of Commons, extremely disciplined, with actually the legislative branch, the House of Commons, fused with and controlled by the cabinet, the executive branch. So it's an extraordinarily centralized government. And the process for selecting appellate judges until very recently, it was simply a matter of picking senior successful barristers. So these were all people who had very similar experience, most of them upper class people, Oxford, Cambridge people. So very similar people operating a centralized system which produced very clear law, clear statutes, no constitution. So it's very cut and dry. So when you read Hart's book, and Professor Leiter will disagree, you have the judges most of the time, even if it's the top rung, you know, the Judicial Committee, the House of Lords, their equivalent Supreme Court, they're going along, it's very cut and dried, you know, really apply. And then every once in a while they come upon a new novel issue, and they get all nervous. And in Hart, you have the sense that they go along 99% of the time. Then they come to a novel issue, and they switch gears. And now they become legislators, and they decide this with a kind of completely uncanalized discretion, like a legislator. And I don't think that captures the psychology of the American judge. I don't think judges feel a discontinuity when they go from applying to creating. I think what American judges feel is the duty to decide is primary, you know, to decide the case with whatever comes to hand as materials for decision. And there's no felt, discontinuity between an adjudicative and a legislative function exercised by judges. So with Ronald Dworkin, he, I think, correctly describes the character of American law I wouldn't put it in his terms, but he certainly emphasized the discretionary element. What I think also unrealistic about him, if you've read any of his work, he has much too ambitious a conception of what judges can do. He sees judges surveying the entire legal landscape and creating an overarching intellectual system which they then apply to individual cases. And I think it's infeasible. Judges don't have the time to do that. They don't have intellectual inclinations. The decisional process is much more ad hoc. But I'd say clearly, reading these people and others from other legal cultures, you get a sense that that although they speak in universal terms, they're really describing their own system.
Sometimes I feel you are as uncharitable to jurisprudence as I am to economics. Dworkin, of course, denies that judges ever exercise any discretion. I quite agree with you that Dworkin is describing something more parochial, Anglo-American experience. I think that's right. On Hart, and we don't want to derail this into a discussion there, but go back to Chapter 7 of The Concept of Law. I think the description is not quite as you presented it, and is actually a bit closer to what I heard you be saying today. So,
I think at this point we'd like to open it up to questions.
Please.
I don't mean to be a probing senator here. I'm wondering to what extent this debate or these questions about methodology are motivated by differences, perhaps, in ideology, wealth maximization, objectivity, say.
I don't really think so, because I think I'm describing what judges are like. I don't think it's anything special to me. I don't feel any. If you look at my experience on the Court of Appeals, I haven't had many disagreements with colleagues. So I notice, for example, we have good and bad lawyers arguing before us, good and bad briefs and so on. But the judges almost always agree on who are the good lawyers and who are the bad lawyers. And what is the characteristics on which they agree is that the good lawyers are the ones who try to give the judges a sense of the practical stakes in a case, try to make the judges really understand it in common sense terms, because the jurisdiction is very broad. The judges have limited acquaintance with particular fields of law and transactions and so on. So the people who can explain why was this transaction structured in this way, and what would be a reasonable outcome? They do much better. I have often said to lawyers, said them in the oral argument, don't try to hit us over the head with a case, right? You wouldn't be here if there were a previous case that decided this case. Just tell us, what would be a reasonable result? And let's say the other judges, they like that. So I don't think it's, I don't think, I mean, clearly, you think in economic terms, I think it, you're moving away from the legal jargon and into a more result-oriented type of thinking. That's true. But I think pragmatism, this is often said, it really is the American national culture. So I think most judges find a pragmatic approach quite congenial. I don't believe, by the way, you know, there's a big disjunction between what judges do and what they say, apart from this sort of conspiracy to fool the lay public. You know, most judicial opinions are not written by judges, they're written by law clerks. So you come out of law school, and it's interesting, young lawyers are very formalistic, and the reason is they don't know anything, right? All they know is what is in law books. They don't know anything about the world. So what do they think? So if they write an opinion, it's going to be in a formalistic mode. And that's going to fool people. So partly it's, you know, it's preserving the myth. But partly it's just what comes naturally to young, inexperienced lawyers. But the judges actually say, and what motivates the decision, is often something you won't be able to dig out of their opinions because they're not really the authors. So, but you know, if you read, especially if you read Supreme Court decisions, they're so incredibly inauthentic. You just know that the extraordinarily intricate analysis of cases and legislative history and American history and what have you, that would not have the judge arrived at his or her decision, right? They didn't do all that work before they voted on the case. It was all done afterwards. Not all of it. It's right. It's rationalization. And, you know, it's extraordinarily rare for a judge. It happens more at our level where the cases are less consequential. It doesn't happen often. It happens occasionally. I think very rarely at the Supreme Court level that a judge, having voted one way and started out to write or commission his law clerks to write an opinion, discovers in the elaborate research into legal, orthodox legal materials that he really should change his vote. That's very rare. As I say, the apparatus you find in the judicial opinions tends to be rationalization rather than an actual explanation of how the decision was reached.
I mean, on this point about ideology, it's worth noting that, I mean, other writers, lawyers, jurists who have expressed the similar views similar to Judge Posner's about what's actually going on. A lot of the legal realists, Carl Llewellyn, Jerome Frank, who was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, Thurman Arnold, who is Arnold and Porter, firm in Washington, D.C., Benjamin Cardozo, their ideological point of view was quite different from Judge Posner's. They were all New Deal liberals, but they had exactly the same view about what was actually going on in adjudication, especially the higher up you went in the appellate process. So I don't think it has much to do with ideology. I think it has to do with a realistic appraisal of what a complicated legal system is like and what kind of cases end up before the appellate courts.
Say that most judges agree most of the time on most things, then there must be some overriding guiding principle that unifies them. What is that, and how do we know it's good and it's right, and what has instilled that into all these people?
No, I don't think there has to be an overriding principle. I think if people are similar in their outlook and experiences and so on, they'll tend to agree on things without having any principle. I mean, so people who grow up in foreign countries and come to the United States, they tend to continue to like the foods that they had as children in the country they came from, right? But that doesn't mean that they have a principle that causes them to converge on a food. It's just that, you know, that's how they were brought up. So similarly, if you have judges who have very similar values, for example, most Americans nowadays believe in a substantial scope for the market, right? So that's going to influence how they react to contract cases. So if someone comes along and says, well, it's true, I didn't read the contract, but I'm just a consumer, and, you know, what do you expect of me? So please relieve me from my foolish agreement. Now, that doesn't get anywhere. There was a case several years ago. It involved forum selection clauses. So you go on a cruise, and on the back of your ticket, it says, you know, in small print, in the event of a dispute arising out of this, I agree it will be litigated in, you know, Anchorage, Alaska, or some other inconvenient form. And Blackman, the bleeding heart, he wrote quite a hard opinion saying, well, you know, it's freedom of contract, you signed it, you looked at the back of the ticket, and too bad. So when you have a strong consensus in the judicial community, not because they're judges, but because it's the America, it's part of the culture, that contracts are good things, and if you don't enforce them, you know, I mean, so look, for example, 30 years ago, before the fall of the Soviet Union and triumph of the market, there was a lot of talk about unconscionability as a defense to contract enforcement. Well, unconscionability has just about vanished because it was connected with, you know, skepticism about freedom of contract. As the skepticism diminishes, doctrines that reflect that skepticism tend to disappear. And it's not because there's a principle involved. It's just a sense that people have because of their experience in society.
There's a lot of talk on both sides of the political spectrum about judicial activism, which I take to mean something along the lines of judges openly flouting the will of the legislature and imposing their own values. And I guess this is considered to be a very bad thing in a lot of circles. How do we square judicial activism, whatever it actually means, with pragmatic adjudication? And in a sense, is judicial activism just the other side of the coin of pragmatic adjudication?
Well, there are two senses of judicial activism. One is that it's just a term of abuse. You know, like what you guys didn't say as an activist. The other, which has more content, is to say judicial activism involves expanding the powers of courts relative to other institutions of government. So a decision that recognizes a new constitutional right, a great set of constitutional right, that would be activist in that sense. On the other hand, if you take a case of a year ago or so, the Kelo case, you know, the eminent domain case, fiercely attacked by conservatives. But it was not an activist decision, because all it said was that, well, if a city wants to condemn property and turn it over to a private developer, that's fine. So this decision allowed the, you know, local government to spread its wings, so to speak. So that's a non-activist decision. It's still wildly popular, unpopular, and of course some people would say it was an activist decision because the Constitution says, you know, you can only take property for a public use. How could this be a public use when the property was turned over to a developer? So you could argue it's a bad decision But it wouldn't be activist in the sense in which I think the term has some utility. As I say, if you just use it as a term of abuse, it doesn't do any work, any useful work.
Given the wide discretion that judges have in a pragmatic view, what is really the purpose of the legislature at all, other than to confirm the judges?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Actually, traditionally in Britain, until the 19th century, really, the function of the legislature was to raise money for the operation of government, really. And the rules of conduct were made by the judges, by the common law. And of course, legislatures have become much more active. And, they pass a variety of laws, obviously, trust laws, securities, pension laws, what have you, tax. The judges couldn't do all that, obviously, too much. So, as I said at the beginning, a statute will do two things. It'll have a kind of heartland, a core, where the thing that the legislators were particularly thinking about, and that will usually be embodied in clear language and apply to a predictable context, the ones that legislatures had in mind. So that's, and then that's the part the judges follow. But ordinarily, all sorts of loose ends in the legislature, and the legislators may indeed have been counting on the judges to use their imagination to apply the statute in situations which the legislatures hadn't foreseen. So partly the legislation creates a rule of conduct, partly it delegates, in effect, to the judges the creation of additional, related rules of conduct based on it. So when you look at a body of statutory law, like the antitrust laws are an example, you really have a statutory kernel and a gigantic fruit that has been created around it by the courts. But of course, the legislature doesn't like it, it can rein the courts in through new statutes.
I think typically Dworkin would reply to your pragmatism by saying that even in hard cases, judges are still interpreting law instead of being legislator. And even though the rules are not clear, they have to do some homework, and they still, by their conscientious work, give some kind of law. And I think that the reason Dworkin is trying to do that is that he tries to make sense of the fact that judges don't feel the discontinuity that you just mentioned when they are reasoning from easy cases to hard cases. And also, I think he tries to make sense of the pervasive belief of people that they have the right when they come to the court. And the Dworkin believes that a right comes only from certain law, whether it's interpreted or mechanically applied, because the rights cannot come from the ad hoc decision of the judges. So to what extent do you think that his two concerns are important, and how do you reply to that?
I think you might if I say something about
sure,
this first. I want to take a slight issue with some of what you said about what Dworkin's view is. I mean, so Ronald Dworkin's view is that there is a right answer as a matter of law in all these cases, and there is no space for discretion. Right? Now, it turns out that the way he thinks you get to this right answer involves a great deal of reasoning that would look very unfamiliar to most judges and lawyers, right? So the right answer as a matter of law, according to Dworkin, is the answer that would follow from the most morally attractive principle that explains at least some portion of the prior decisions, legislative enactments, constitutional materials of that that particular legal system. And so we have to engage in a great deal of moral reasoning and argumentation to figure out which principle ought to be controlling. But what I particularly want to take issue with, though, is the question, why does he think that there is a right answer as a matter of law in all these cases? Partly he invokes the rhetoric of the judicial decisions and the way lawyers and judges talk about it. And I mean, Judge Posner has already said something very close to things that H.L.A. Hart said about this, which is you shouldn't necessarily take the rhetoric at face value. It may, in fact, be misleading. Judges can have all kinds of reasons for wanting to describe every case as having a legally predetermined answer, right? It insulates the judge from a certain kind of criticism, among other things. Dworkin thinks, and this is really the crucial fact about his view, he thinks that unless there is a right answer as a matter of law in these cases, courts would never be morally justified in coercing the parties before the court. And he thinks in the absence of a right answer, if courts were really exercising discretion, what they're doing would be morally indefensible. So in a way, he has a very strong version of the third question I put originally. It's not that it's inconsistent with democracy. It would just be morally illegitimate, he thinks, for a court to create a new rule rather than discovering a pre-existing legal right. And so then the real issue with Dworkin has to do with why does he think that that is true? And of course, many writers disagree with him about this issue.
I was reading like the Ninth Circuit's batting average when it goes to the Supreme Court is pretty darn low, and I was wondering what your thoughts about that, either in general or related to that circuit, were, and if you think that if the Supreme Court's constantly overturning you as an appellate judge, is that a sign you're obliterating signposts, or is that more just pragmatic differences that are unavoidable under a pragmatic approach to jurisprudence?
Well, there's going to be a lot of disagreement, and I think the Supreme Court reverses about 80% of the cases that it grants. But as you say, they grant a disproportionate number of Ninth Circuit cases, and they reverse a disproportionate number. And I don't see the point of what the Ninth Circuit is doing. I don't understand, because if you get reversed, your decision is wiped out. You've wasted your time. So, and of course, they get a reputation for being defiant, and then. The Supreme Court looks ever more critically at their decisions. And it's probably a factor in the movement. I suppose the movement probably been arrested now by the election, but the movement has split up the Ninth Circuit. So I don't see under any view, really, that kind of behavior by lower court judges would advance their goals. I don't understand.
Judge Posner, you referred earlier to the conspiracy of judges to create this myth about what law does. I guess my question is, do you think that there's any social value to that myth? And if you do, I guess, why don't you engage in that myth?
No, I don't think it has any value. The other branches of government have become much more transparent, and partly because of very aggressive media and so on, partly because of general decline of authority in our society. We have much more insight into the realities of American government. But the judiciary has been very good at maintaining a high level of secrecy. So the secrecy and the conspiracy, I am obviously not in a literal sense, they reinforce each other, because the judges put out this line, about they're just applying the law. But then by the secrecy that they're able to enforce on their proceedings, they prevent the pretense from being unmasked. So there are no sunshine laws for judicial deliberations. There are the occasional leaks in the scandal books, you know, the Lazarus, before them, the Brethren. But they're rare. So an interesting question would be whether judicial proceedings should be recorded. It's a curiosity that I don't know how many Americans are aware of, but you know, the English, until very recently, they had this, the English judiciary had this principle of what they called orality. And orality meant that everything the judges did had to be public, which meant that judges, of course, they couldn't have law clerks, they couldn't have libraries, they couldn't have deliberations. So the way an English appeal, finally became overwhelmed by case law pressures, but until quite recently, if there was an appeal, the judges would not receive any documents in advance. No briefs, nothing. The lawyer for the appellant would get up and explain what the case was about. And if he wanted the judges to read anything, he'd hand them something to read. If he relied on a case, he'd hand them a book with a case in it, and they'd sit and read the book. So you could have an oral argument that lasted for weeks. And at the end, the judges would not retire to deliberate, but instead each one would give his opinion, orally. And then at the end, you'd add up and figure out who won. And the English thought this was very, very important, because this meant everything the judges were doing was in the open and could be monitored by the public. So we've gone to the opposite extreme. We have a large amount of ghostwriting by the anonymous law clerks, and the judges deliberating in private and so on. And the Supreme Court has the most elaborate security precautions, where law clerks have to sign pledges, not to reveal what's going on. So I don't see the point, really. Why shouldn't they be as transparent as other officials? All they'd learn if our deliberations, the Supreme Court's deliberations, were recorded, is how little actual deliberation there is. Because the judges are in a hurry, and they don't want to wrangle. And what you would notice, I'm sure it's true at the Supreme Court, certainly true at my level, is that there's less discussion the more controversial the case is. Because if a case is technical, commercial, unimportant, no strong emotions are engaged, then the judges will discuss it and may change their minds, and so on. The judges may know more about the subject matter. But if it involves a hot subject, if it involves religion, abortion, what have you, then the judges are very reluctant to discuss it, because people don't like to discuss. They don't like to argue over things that are very important to them, things with which they're emotionally engaged, right? There are a lot of taboo subjects. You don't go up to a person and say, I met your wife last night, and she's okay, but I think you could have done better. You don't go up to a religious person and say, you don't believe all that baloney, the soul and all that superstitious nonsense. So that's why I think what people would see, if we were transparent, I think they would see that the judges are impartial in what seems to me the the real meaning of the rule of law, which is that the judges do not, they do not get hung up on the personal characteristics of the litigants and whether they like the lawyer or dislike the lawyer. And they're not particularly sympathetic to the, you know, individual. Because they tend to see the parties as representatives of general interest positions, what have you. Sellers, buyers, not the individual seller, the individual buyer. There isn't much sentimental attraction to a particular party. So I think they'd be reassured. I mean, the answer to your question, all you can really expect if you're at the misfortune to be a litigant is that you will have an impartial judge who will not vote against you because he doesn't like you. You're an unlikable person. So that's about all. So I say impartiality is very important, but I think in my experience, judges are quite impartial. That's part of the rules of the game. You know, if you want to be a judge, if you enjoy being a judge, it's partly because you do abstract from the personal characteristics of the litigants. You see them as representative activities rather than as individuals with a sob story.
I think we have time for one more question.
When you're deciding a case and are trying to determine what is the best automatic resolution of the problem, in a situation when you think that what you think is the best and what the majority of the country think is the best, I think the problem is defined as a counter-majoritarian difficulty. What is the approach that you take and what do you think is the correct approach for judges to take in this situation?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by what the country thinks.
Let's assume that we're talking about abortion, and let's say majority of the Americans think that abortion should be prohibited, and let's say we don't have Roe v. Wade, and you are the judge to decide whether we should allow it or not. What do you think, as a judge, your duty is to follow what the majority thinks, or what do you think is the best?
Well, you couldn't give controlling weight to majority to public opinion because for two reasons. One is that when you're talking about the Constitution. Constitutional rights are often invoked by minorities, and there's a recognition that there is a significant social value in allowing, you know, minority opinions to be expressed and so on. And discrimination laws similarly. So minority rights are a significant part of the legal fabric. So you wouldn't want to consult a public opinion poll. I do think there are situations in which public opinion is significant. That's my reaction to the gay marriage issue. If a state wants to permit gay marriage, I don't care. But the idea that a court would force it on a state seems to me very questionable because, on the one hand, there is very strong public opposition, and on the other hand, there really isn't anything that one can say, I think, about the subject, except some people think, well, you know, if people want to get married, that's fine, let's no skin off my teeth. And other people think it degrades the concept of marriage or it offends them in some way. I don't see any way to adjudicate between those positions. And this is where the issue of judicial activism comes in. You could say, well, if you have issues on which there's strong public feelings, and there really isn't powerful arguments, not orthodox legal materials, but any class of arguments you particularly find persuasive, one way or the other, then you know, why not leave it to the political process? So, one of the vices of judicial activism is that it tends to extinguish social experiments. So, you know, there's the decision, the Zelman decision a few years ago, where the Supreme Court upheld voucher systems for private schools. So a city could decide that it wanted to give parents money that they could use to enroll their kids in private schools, including religious schools. And there was an argument, persuaded some of the Supreme Court justices that this violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, but majority said no. So if the Supreme Court had said that vouchers were unconstitutional, that would have stifled an important social experiment. Because one of the things one would like to learn from a voucher system is whether, given that this would provide a lot of additional money for private education, whether it would actually stimulate the growth of secular private schools. So you don't learn that if the Supreme Court were to say that every state is to allow gay marriage, then to have a uniform rule for the whole country, you wouldn't be able to compare states which allow gay marriage, states that don't allow gay marriage. And since it would be a constitutional decision, it would be extremely difficult to undo, and of course would cause endless controversy. So the people who debate gay marriage, much of it is, you know, religious or emotional, what have you, but people will actually make factual claims occasionally, like homosexuals make bad parents or what have you. Well, if you have diverse state responses, you can compare and see, you know, have a state which permits gay marriage, what happens, how many people get married, what are the consequences, is the moral fabric of the state somehow affected. But if you impose it nationwide and then make it a constitutional decision that can't easily be revoked, you think it's a precipitate response.
So should Loving versus Virginia have been decided the other way? Since after all, there were empirical arguments about miscegenation.
Yeah, you know what the Supreme Court does? Not always, not in Roe versus Wade, but usually what it does, it waits until public opinion has swung decisively in favor of a particular position, leaving some regional minority as a holdout that lops off that deviant branch. So when the Supreme Court held in Griswold versus Connecticut that it was illegal, that it was unconstitutional to forbid the sale of contraceptives for married couples, there are only two states, Massachusetts and Connecticut, that had such laws. So what the Supreme Court was really doing was, you know, sort of enforcing a national consensus against a couple of holdouts, you know, heavily Catholic states. And similarly with all the segregation cases like Loving and, of course, Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court waited, in effect, until segregation was rejected by a strong national majority and it was confined to a region. and then, you know, it could bring about enforce the national consensus. Because, you know, the opposition to segregation, segregated schools, other segregated facilities, was very gradual. I think as late as 1948, Indiana had segregated schools. So segregation was not just a Deep South phenomenon. But you know, World War II had an impact on this, and you know, by the 50s, the South was really quite isolated in its extreme racism. So at that point, the Supreme Court could weigh in. But when they intervened prematurely, as I think they did in Roe versus Wade, just from a political standpoint, then they generate endless trouble, right? Because so perverse. So Roe versus Wade made the right to life movement. Just the way Bush, you know, thanks to Bush, the American Civil Liberties Union has vastly increased donations to it. They're probably very disappointed at the election results. So what the Supreme Court could have done, you know, Roe versus Wade, there's a companion case, Doe versus Bolton, which involved a Georgia abortion statute, which was much more liberal. It was somewhat more liberal than the Texas statute. And the Supreme Court could have said, well, the Texas statute goes too far. That's unconstitutional. But the Georgia statute, you know, that's more liberal. So we'll uphold that. Now, a decision like that would have stirred much less controversy because, you know, the pro-life people would say, yeah, well, Texas did go pretty far. But Georgia, you know, it's still pretty anti-abortion. You had to get a doctor's permission or you had to get permission from someone. And so that would have been a compromise. And then you'd see how the states lined up, whether they fell in line and how much they resisted. So this type of judgment, how far to go, how far to buck public opinion, I think that's an inescapable part of the judicial discretion that a Supreme Court exercises. And that's just, it illustrates the fact that you can't really decide these cases on a basis of principles.
Thank you all for coming. Let's give a great hand.